Hey, 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 we are back. We are still the Microsoft Virtual Academy. And this time, though, we're going to dig a little bit deeper. We've got Louis Desjardins. Mm-hmm. Thank you very much for coming. And we're going to look at some of the internals of .NET, ASP.NET 5. Let's go to the slides and start my timer for me there. So, Louis, you're a principal software engineer, and you're focusing on ASP.NET 5 and the kind of the core runtime that makes it all happen.
Yeah, I have been for a little bit now. This is something that was quite a long time coming. So you've probably seen the momentum building towards this type of direction. It's kind of like phase shift of the technology. Mm-hmm. And so the last year, you know, there has been pretty busy inside the buildings at Redmond, getting all of these pieces to come together and it's amazing how much technology has really clicked together in just the last year. It's kind of amazing to see everything that's always worked in the past start to light up on a completely different CLR.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it really is a completely different CLR. You're changing the brain, you know, while the person is still walking.
Changing the brain from carbon to silicon without hopefully the person noticing. So .NET is able to run on the core CLR now, which is a completely different build of largely the same language and runtime, mm-hmm. but it's completely self-contained and has no overlap with the desktop CLR in terms of what files are used at runtime or necessary.
Not to mention that we also just happened to switch compilers during this entire little event as well. They called it the big switch as we went from the regular C# compiler to Roslyn. Mm. So there's that as well to think about.
Oh yeah, and that's also something that The team that does that has done an amazing job also. The compatibility bar that they have to hit in order to even consider doing something like that is tremendous. And at the end of the day, it really is kind of seamless. It does, if anything, unlock more scenarios. For example, if you don't want to compile all of your code in advance, you can compile it on the fly, you know, which makes, you know, the use of views more, well, you know, more first class because everything can be compiled on the fly, but class libraries as well. You don't need to have everything compiled to a DLL before your program starts running. So it both modes are available. Both ways of running as DLL or as source are available, but it just opens up those options that are available on other languages too.
As he takes a sip, I'll remind you that he worked actually on Dow Jones and Marketplace, and he had a bunch of big stuff, MarketWatch, and you also created Spark. That was kind of like your initial claim to fame. A lot of people in the community were really a fan of the Spark view engine.
Oh, yeah. That one was kind of, that one predated Razor a little bit.
Yeah.
It was where their MVC was coming out. It had the ability to add pluggable view engines. And WebForms was the only syntax that was available in the MVC, so it kind of created a vacuum that
yep.
made an opening for open source to become popular. When Razor came out, Spark was really kind of, the need for it wasn't as much. So at the moment, it's kind of a lot of people still like it, but it's very niche.
Mm-hmm. But there are some incredibly large sites that we cannot name that people probably use all the time that use Spark.
Oh, yeah. People who like it still love it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Very cool. And I am still me, and there's still a random slide with me on it, so enjoy that. And all right, cool. Let's talk about some things. Now, we'll probably spend a little more time at the command line, but I want to understand as much as what's going on internally around the hosting runtime as we can. So please, educate me.
Sure. Well, I suppose the first thing, like you say, we can take a look at is the command line, starting with our favorite, well, you know, command prompt. Our favorite command, KVM. I suppose I should speak briefly about the different commands and what the responsibilities are.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, you know, names are in flux, so everything is coming in very quickly.
So it's called K because there was originally a thing called Katana, right? And then Project K.
Oh, actually, I think it's the...
Is that why it's called K? Or is it just a letter we had up for
you? I think it's a letter. It's a letter that
really?
Hasn't been used yet. I think so.
Hmm.
Yeah.
I think a lot of us just saw the K and we said, oh, this must be Katana.
Oh, well, I mean, it's an assumption you can make. It doesn't really build a lot on that, other than a lot of the concepts incubated there.
Mm.
Other than incubation, though, it's largely a thing on its own. You know, I don't know if you've heard, is Project N a public term?
Project N, I think, is what they called .N native before.
Yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Another example of, oh, that's a nice letter. Let's use that letter.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yep. So letter-based programming. And in this case, we're starting off with the letter K.
Okay.
So everything that starts with K is going to be related to this particular runtime.
Okay.
The first thing you're going to need before you can do any programming is a SDK. Which gets you the ability to compile things and run them in the runtime as well as the devtime tooling.
Okay.
In order to make it as easy as possible to bootstrap your system, we've provided a single command line that has two jobs. Its first job is to download the K runtime environment, and the second job is to let you pick between the ones that you have downloaded.
Oh, so this will download it too if you want.
Oh, yeah, yeah. As you can see, if you type KVM, that'll bring up the help. And the two commands you need to know are KVM install and KVM use. So KVM install, like you just alluded to, is basically the downloader. And if it's already installed, it won't do anything. But we can ask for the AMD64. I don't think I've installed this one yet.
Well, it really is going and getting it.
Yeah.
In that case, what's it say?
In this case, it says...
Not found.
Oh, we might not have internet. This might be an interesting demo. So, if it was available, it would be basically saying that it's downloaded it.
You could put yourself on MS Open if you want to.
No, it'll be fine.
Okay.
It'll be fine. It'll be fine. So, what it's doing is downloading the SDK and unzipping it. You can see the location it unzips it to. Is right in your user profile directory.
Right, we saw
so that. So that you don't need to be administrator to get started, and you don't need to make a permanent commitment on your machine. It hasn't changed the registry or done an MSI yet. We'll have those available, but to get started, all you have to do is say KVM install and choose a version, and then it is in your user profile.
And speaking of a lack of commitment, I noticed that it put it in the path, but just for this one process as well.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep. That's what KVM use is for. So if we list, we can see the different versions that I've installed over time.
Mm-hmm.
And one of them is marked active. The active star, this is very low tech. All it really means is this is the one that's on your path. On this particular command prompt.
In this command prompt, not your machine path.
Right, yeah. If you want to make it more permanent, you can say KVM use... a different number, and persist. That will persist it for the current user. So if I log out and log back in, that one will be on the path still. It's just changing the path user environment variable.
Mm-hmm.
There is also a global. Global in this case just means the machine path.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. But you don't need to do either of those in order to get started or work.
I saw some situations where people will install a preview of Visual Studio, which I think is currently beta 1.
Yes.
Then they will go and get the command line for KVM, and they'll immediately do an upgrade.
Yes.
And then things start breaking in Visual Studio. Why is that?
Oh, well, Visual Studio is also not, in the same vein as the command line, it's not doing a global install of the KRE to run off of. It does have a copy that comes with its install, but it's kind of squirreled away. And what it's doing is it's expanding it into your user profile as you need it. If you do KVM upgrade, it's grabbing the latest, which could be the nightly build, and putting it on your machine. The other thing it'll do is change the alias default. Today, that's what Visual Studio was looking at.
An alias called default, and I see you have one right there. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Okay.
And that's going to become something that's... the tooling is also evolving as we speak. So as more and more things become solid and as we learn more about how people use this and want to use it, we are refining how those kind of selections are made to where, in the project properties, you'll be able to say which one you want if you don't want to go to the default.
Right.
So you'll be able to pin a particular project to a version of the KRE. And then it'll just use that one.
And it also begs the question, if you do run a KVM upgrade, bring down the latest version, did you mean for it to become the new default, or did you just want to get
it? Oh, certainly, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yep. That by default, currently, like you said, it's all in flux, breaks Visual Studio, confuses Visual Studio, because you have to go and set a default back yourself?
Oh, well, that's the difference between install and upgrade. If you're talking about install, it's just downloading one and making it available.
Ah.
If you talk about upgrade, that's kind of an all-in-one step.
So that's my fault for using it then.
Or it's the tool's fault for not documenting it. But what KVM upgrade is doing is it's finding the very latest one it can, it's downloading it, installing it, and changing default to point to it.
See, everything there was good except for the changing default to point to it.
Okay.
For me.
Yeah.
But I think the point here is, though, if you do choose to start playing at the command line, you do have the information available. I didn't know what I was doing, but I did notice default moved. I saw it change, and I can also control my active one. So it's not hidden from you.
Oh, yeah. And it's actually an interesting point. We can take a look at how some of these actually are implemented. As you can see in my profile, there's a .kre directory. So this is just my user profile. You can see all my folders. And in .kre packages, this is where they're unzipped.
Yep, just sitting there.
This is just some NuGet files, because that was the packaging format.
Right.
And here are where the rest of the commands live. So k and kpm are both batch files that are themselves, like kpm runs this DLL. This is the program main for kpm. Kpm itself is just a batch file. So it's all very low tech. And like you say, when you're using the command line to download these things and make one active, it's not doing anything complicated. It's just unzipping the files and changing the path to point at one of them.
And you could even go so far as to say it's not doing anything destructive.
Yes, you can delete that and they are gone. Even the question of aliases. People have asked, how is that information saved? And then they reply right away and say, oh, I looked and it's right here in these text files. You know, that's as complicated as the alias.
It's pretty white box.
Yeah. Yep. It's meant to be delete friendly.
And I even found that I could delete both those folders, and it still wouldn't break stuff. Visual Studio still works. I can still run the KV. I can still go back and re-download it all again. Like, if I got myself really screwed up, I could get back without too much trouble.
Yep. And that's one of the things. And that's one of the things that's interesting. When you start to pop the hood open on some of these, just like the old VW Beetles, the moving parts are so simple that you can sort of tinker with it. And you know, it's simple enough that you can understand how it's working, and that lets you understand what you can do with it. Like if you need to sort of like xcopy deploy to a server, you know how the things work. You know how they relate to each other. You know that this folder full of DLLs is 100% of what you need to run. And so, you know, there's a lot of strength in that. That said, it's always partnered with tooling that hides it from you. So you're not exposed to that level first.
So an important reminder, in case it isn't completely obvious, this is the advanced part of the day. You don't need to know any of this stuff. You can just let Visual Studio handle it and choose to do it. It's the same kind of thing where over the years you've learned a lot about the .NET framework, and many of you never went into C, Windows, you know, System32, yada, 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 and looked to see where the actual MS Core lib is. You lived and worked successfully as engineers, never caring how that worked. That's great. This is advanced plumbing 101 that we're doing right here. So don't feel sad if you don't get or care about any of this stuff.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Exactly in the same way that you can go your entire career and never edit a CS proj. And that, I mean, you're happy, and that's, you know, the success of Visual Studio right there.
Maybe talk a little bit about scoping, because I understand it took me a while to figure out that KVM is always and everywhere. But K and KPM are specific to the version.
Sure. And that's easy to illustrate if we take a look in this directory. Here's KVM.
Oh, that's all it is?
Yeah, that's all it is. It's two text files. And we'll have an MSI for this as well. To get to a couple of text files.
Which, why do we need an MSI for a couple of text files?
It's hard to install text files from the command line. Windows doesn't really have a curl, those kind of tricks that you'd find in other places. And a lot of people don't really feel comfortable going to a web page, copying a big command line, and pasting it into a command prompt.
Yeah.
And, you know, feeling confident that it did what they wanted. So, you know, for those reasons, we'll have an MSI that set these up and put them on the path for you. But they themselves are just text files.
And they're always, and they're in your, if they're in your path, so when you set this up, it's in your path, that folder right there.
Yep. So this folder is put on your path just so that KVM is available.
Okay.
And then when you say KVM use defaults here, it's changed the path so that the old runtime is no longer in the path. The one I just asked for is,
Okay.
KVM hasn't changed, though.
Okay.
But now, if I do KPM, it's running the KPM batch file out of this bin directory. And mm-hmm. this is saying, you know, here's the version number. This actually ran the managed code on top of this runtime. So you know, the KPM is running on itself. It's part of the SDK, and it uses its own host process in there to run.
What if I'm watching this and I'm having mixed feelings about the most advanced, cool thing to come out of our team being based on batch files? And when I say batch files, I don't mean literally batch files, but it's like we're kind of back to scripting, but it's very clean and it's very simple and it's very kind of elegant. But at the same time, I think maybe we just thought it would be more sophisticated.
Well, that's the thing. A lot of times sophistication is good if it's the only way that you can accomplish something. If there is an existing paradigm that is solid and has been in Windows and other platforms since computers existed, if that capability is there and you take advantage of it, you've accomplished your goal, you know. So it's really, you know, if it ain't broken, you know, choosing a runtime based on what is currently on your path is how all of these, you know, languages, if you take a look at them, work at the end of the day. And so why be any different? Mm-hmm.
So when I type KVM on a Mac or a Linux machine, it'll be a shell script.
Yes, yep.
Mm-hmm. And everything else will work the same, pathing and environment variables and all that kind of stuff.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yep, that's exactly right. And the part that's managed code is the same managed code. The only thing that's different is the CLR that you'll be running it on top of.
Really? So when you said KPM is, in our case, a batch file or a PowerShell file that points to package manager DLL, the same exact thing applies on a Linux or a Mac?
Yes. On Linux, it would be kpm.sh or a bash file of some sort. And then, exactly that.
All right. Let's switch back to the slides real quick just to make a bookmark point there.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so KPM
scoped
now to a particular version of the runtime that you've selected.
Mm-hmm, yep. So KPM is your single command for all of the SDK commands that you need to run.
Okay.
And so within an SDK, there are a number of things you need to do. Downloading dependencies, compiling a project, turning a project into a NuGet package, getting ready for deployment. All of those things all are in the KPM umbrella. So everything that the SDK needs to do for you, the commands are located in there.
Sometimes people have looked at KPM and said, oh, this is like NPM. Mm-hmm. Is it like that and more?
Well, I think it's exactly like that. And .NET specific, though. So it has a number of commands so far. It is much like NPM, but it is based on the NuGet standards, of course, and it is based on using Roslyn to create assemblies and to create NuGet packages.
Mm-hmm.
Other than that, metaphorically, it's a very similar to that. If you're familiar with what NPM can do, you will probably find an analog. And if you're familiar with .NET, of course you'll find an analog because build. Mm-hmm.
Now, we have KPM restore. That's like NPM install.
Mm-hmm.
But then we have KPM install. What is the difference between install and restore then?
Oh, yeah. Install might be something that'll change in a little bit. Install is a slightly different gesture. It's where you add a dependency to a project and then run restore. So it's a dual command. So install means add plus restore.
So that's interesting. So that's now the second time where I've gotten confused by dual commands. KVM upgrade, did a bunch of stuff.
Yeah.
And KPM install is something, is an add and a restore?
And, you know, for those reasons, and, you know, it's definitely open to feedback, and we're getting feedback constantly from from the world. The commands like that will probably evolve and change.
If I were going to make with a notepad a project.json and write a startup.cs, that tells me, you know, here are my dependencies and here's my startup. And we saw that in Daniel's talk where he made a hello world. Would I run then KPM restore to bring down the dependencies and then?
Well, you certainly can. And you can also do that directly from Visual Studio if you're using it. The IDE sort of contains all of that for you and is running restore in the background.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But that is exactly what you would do. You would author a project JSON, run KPM restore, and then your binaries are available to run, you know, so you can fire right up from there. Should we fire up a copy of Visual Studio and do something like that?
Sure, if you want to. Let's not, we don't want to duplicate too much of what we've already seen, because I really like learning some of this context that you're giving me that I haven't seen before.
Oh, okay. Well, just let me know anytime you'd like to see some of it actually.
Yeah, sure. Mm-hmm. Talk to me about RAP. Oh. That seems like it bridges two worlds.
It does. KPM RAP is something that's being added just now, and it's something that will hopefully light up in some of the very near additions of Visual Studio. Mm-hmm. What it is when you have a project JSON, it can depend on other project JSONs. It can also depend on NuGet packages. So we're kind of unifying the unit of dependency. You know, in CSproj, there was always a kind of a disconnect between I'm referencing an assembly versus another CSproj.
Well, yeah.
And when you reference NuGet, it's kind of like referencing an assembly, but it's someplace else. So in this project type, those are all unified. When you depend on something by name, you depend on it by name. And if it is a NuGet project or another K project, it doesn't really matter. They're functionally equivalent. When you have a dependency, you have a dependency. And a project and a package are the same. The thing that's missing is existing code. If you have a CS project in your solution already, if you have any of that existing asset that you want to, you know, reuse, and everybody does want to reuse their existing works, you need abilities to reference CSproj from a project JSON conveniently. And that's where this tool enters in. So it's a new command, kpm wrap on a CSproj, will generate a project JSON in a kind of a standalone location. Mm-hmm. And then you can reference that as well. So from your project, you can start a ASP.NET 5 web application or class library or command line application, wrap existing CSproj class libraries, mm-hmm. And they suddenly become ASP.NET 5 visible projects. And it goes through them transitively. So if you wrap class library A, and it's using three NuGet packages and two DLLs and one other CSproj that's also using two NuGet packages, all of that sort of becomes transparently accessible to your original application. So it'll follow the dependencies down, and it'll all work from your web application. So an ASP.NET 5 web application can reference that graph of CSproj technology, and mm-hmm. it'll all come together.
So thinking perhaps it's overly simplistically, a number of people are always asking the question about, like, what does the upgrade scenario look like? Maybe you could put some of that in the context, because they might say, oh, look, RAP is the magical way that I will bring my giant 70 projects from over there to over here. But that doesn't answer the desktop CLR versus core CLR issue. Mm-hmm. That just says these are now available as references in the context of an ASP.NET 5 project.
Yeah, it's all about options and how much you want to bite off in terms of porting. So KPM wrap is, oh, one last thing. In Visual Studio, you can, when you right-click add reference mm-hmm. and do a project-to-project reference, that's the Visual Studio gesture for that. You won't have to run KPM wrap yourself.
I see.
So if you go to ASP.5 project, right-click add reference to a .NET 4.5 class library,
it'll be running in the same solution.
Yeah. It just looks like a reference appeared and works. That is the quickest way to get existing class libraries available in a K project. There are other ways, which are, mostly efforts of porting. You can put a project JSON in the same directory, and by convention, it will see all of the source, and it'll. You can switch to that as your project type instead of the class library, and so you, in that way, you can migrate your entire application bit by bit. Mm-hmm. The thing that a lot of time was spent on actually in the class library that Visual Studio is running for ASP.NET vNext is combined IntelliSense. So if you choose to go that route, and you go into your project JSON and say this thing runs on .NET 4.5, the full desktop framework, ASP.NET 5.0, ASP.NET Core 5.0, if you choose all three of those as places that you want that code to run, it will give you the combined IntelliSense to let you know anytime you've used an API that's not available on any of those three. So as you're programming...
Is it three?
Sure, yes.
What is the third?
Oh, if you, in your project JSON, if you say ASP.NET 50,
right.
ASP.NET Core 50,
right.
And .NET 4.5.
Oh.
Yeah. If you do that in your project JSON, you've technically created a package with three DLLs. One of them is for .NET 4.5 framework applications, the full framework, the full framework, the one that we're using today. If you say KPM build on that, it will create an upkeg with those three DLLs in there. And that's a way that you can continue to create software that runs on multiple frameworks and has one single project type and creates an upkeg that can be then shared and imported by other solutions.
I see. So if I have, if I'm a person that makes a library that I'm going to give to other people within my enterprise, I could manually build out three DLLs, and I can say use that one for Windows Phone and that one for ASP.NET 5 and use that one for today. I could do portable class libraries and hopefully make one that works everywhere, but probably would not. Or in this new world, basically I have single source and some perhaps some ifdefs, perhaps not. We automatically fan out and make three DLLs, but they're automatically put into one package. So you think about one build artifact, and I hand that one thing to you, and no matter what context and you use it in, it will work.
Yeah, yeah, that's
so exactly. So it's not a portable class library, as it is a smart NuGet that feels portable.
When you say in Visual Studio, file new ASP.NET 5 class library, like we mentioned before, the class library is actually the project is a package. The project and the NuGet package are the same. So what you're working on is a single project, that's one NuGet package, multiple target frameworks.
Okay.
And the IntelliSense shows you that. In Visual Studio, there's that dropdown where you can choose. You can choose which one you want to focus on, but it's giving you the warnings. You've used something that's only available in .NET 4.5. You better change that. And like you said, ifdefs are available as a last resort. Nobody ever wants to ifdef their code like crazy, but every once in a while you do hit a place where something works one place and not the other, and so you can choose to ifdef. And then when you hit compile, there's one compile, one NupKeg comes out. It's just that the DLLs in the two different locations have different behavior as appropriate for them.
One thing I think I got a little bit confused about, though, is that you said I can say ASP.NET 50, as you say, ASP.NET 5, ASP.NET 5, you know, core 5. Then you said .NET 4.5. I thought ASP.NET 5 runs on .NET 4.5. What's the difference between ASP.NET 5 and .NET 4.5?
That's actually a good way to put it. ASP.NET 5.0 runs on the .NET 4.5 CLR, but it is itself the process container. It's the programming model. So ASP.NET 5.0 and ASP.NET Core 5.0 both have the same application model, both have the same programming model. If you have a program class with a main entry point, you can do dependency injection in the program class's constructor in order to get hosting services. That's because you're running in a host that understands dependency injection. So those are all qualities of the ASP.NET 5.0 runtime environment. If you are compiling for .NET 4.5, you're not assuming that you're in that runtime environment. So things like a program main where the program class has a constructor with dependency injection, you would not want to do that in the .NET 4.5 case.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So ASP.NET 5, while it runs fine on .NET 4.5 and .NET 4.5, it's not then running in the context of this new environment that provides so much. It's running in the context of kind of like the classic ASP.NET EXE.
If you were going to be making a Windows, you know, forms application or a straight .NET 4.5 command line EXE, there you would be using the .NET 4.5 target framework name. If you were creating something that was going to be running with, you know, the dependency injection and the new tools and the new configuration and was going to be switching between the two frameworks, that's where you'd be using the ASP.NET 50 or ASP.NET Core 50.
Okay. But if I'm, you know, JSON.NET author or I'm writing an XML parser or any kind of non-UI specific thing, any of the thousands of library NuGet packages, what should they do today to start getting ready? They should start to build their stuff in this project system.
It's certainly an option. And that's one of the things that we're hoping that the tools like Wrap will make more powerful and compelling options available for them. Because they do have a lot of CS projects that are existing, and a lot of those are coming together in a single NuGet package. So one of the ways that you can arrange it is to have a project JSON for the ASP.NET 50 and ASP.NET Core 50 targets, and then KPM wrap the other CS projects that exist in your solution. So you can kind of have a hybrid where three of the DLLs are created by the existing CS projects, and the other ones are created when Project K sort of scoops everything together and makes an upkeg.
Okay. All right. Let's move on our slide deck there to custom commands. We've mm-hmm. seen that you can make these custom commands in project.json, mm-hmm. that pack generates batch file wrappers for each of those. Mm-hmm. But I'm not really clear on what the command is. It is just a main inside of a DLL?
Oh, sure. We can take a look at that. It is just a main inside of a DLL. If we go into... we can take a look at this one. We see that it has two commands defined. And when you say K to run something,
right,
you can say what the command name is immediately afterwards. This command name is looked up in this section, and this is substituted for what the user had in the command line. So I could say K hello, or I could say K hello world.
So it's an alias.
It's an alias, basically, yeah.
I see.
It's an alias plus additional arguments if you want to put them in line.
Okay.
This hello world that we're looking at right there, or this Microsoft ASP.NET hosting, mm-hmm. that's the assembly name that has the program main in it. All right?
Gotcha.
So when you say K web, it's telling you find program main in this DLL and pass it some more options. So when you say K web, what you're really doing is you're giving control to Microsoft ASP.NET hosting.dll program main, and it's the thing that's saying starting. And not telling you the port, but then continuing to start up a server that is going to be hosting your web application.
Okay. Why, and I'm just thinking about the audience, why would I want a console app? Like I see you brought in system.console, you can say K hello world. What is the difference between saying K hello world and just saying hello world.exe?
Well, for running on different CLRs, at the moment, Core CLR doesn't have the idea of creating a native executable image. Mm-hmm. So that's what that is really providing for you. The K is really providing for you. Is
like when you say mono on Linux.
Exactly. You say mono, you say Java, you say Ruby, Python. All of those have a host process that is your language stack. And then the first argument is the program that's being run. So same thing in this case. If you say K space hello world, it's going to find hello world DLL and run it. If you're running cross-platform, your experience is going to be the same then. You don't have a Windows executable that you're x-copying to another operating system. You have a bunch of managed DLLs. You copy them to the other operating system, and they run exactly as they're intended to. The other operating system would have a different host process. Mm. Like you say, the other operating system might have, you know, whatever is native in that location that can run a CLR. And from that point forward, it's bootstrapping the runtime environment,
right,
and then bootstrapping your code, and then everything else runs normally.
And those things are usually symbolic links or aliases on other platforms. I mean, Java, Python, Ruby.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep. It's all going to be the same thing. When you say Java, hello world.jar.
Yeah, yeah.
Whatever is the Java that is on the path for that command prompt,
right,
is going to start up, load your program, and run.
Kind of does make you wonder about our name, though. Mm-hmm. You said the naming is in flux.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. K. Mm-hmm.
Mm. Yeah. You know, these things are all. I remember NuGet itself had kind of like a community input on the naming. It fluctuates and evolves until everything comes together in the end.
Indeed.
So yeah, we expect lots of feedback.
So then on the next slide here, we talk about hosting. Mm-hmm. So in this context then, you said that K is the bootstrapper, the application host. I like the parallel that you drew with Python and Ruby and all those other kinds of things. That makes sense, the language host. Mm-hmm. But up-leveling and think about a different kind of hosting your web application, while they're all going to be hosted in this example in that runtime, you can have, you said Microsoft at ASP.NET, hosting, but you said server Kestrel. What is that? And are you saying I can host my web apps in different containers, different hosts?
Oh, absolutely. And one of the things that's also kind of interesting mentioning hosting is that there's not a lot of difference between a command line program and a web application and something hosted by IIS.
Really?
It's all the same project type, yeah. It's what happens when it starts that makes them different.
Because I think people who are like been in the industry a long time, they're like, well, that's totally different. It's entirely foreign. And you're saying that they're pretty much the same.
They actually are pretty much the same. The one that's different would be IIS, because it's giving you a different process, and you're running inside that process. Other than that, everything is pretty much the same. The Node example, the difference between a Node command line application and a Node web application really is whether or not it starts listening on a HTTP port. Other than that, they're identical. And the same is true in this case. You can have things like EF migrations that you run as commands from the command line in the same code base that is a web server. If you run it as web, it just runs the web server and loads the actual HTTP implementation, which is pluggable. And that same file system location can be set up to run on IIS and IIS Express if it is pointed at that same location. So one project, and this is an example of that, can be set up to run all three of those ways. And in Visual Studio, in the properties pages, you actually get to choose in the dropdown.
Right.
You get to choose between IIS Express, web, and hello. You're basically saying what happens when you press F5.
But in Visual Studio, IIS Express appears in Visual Studio, but not in the project.json, because that's a totally different way. Like, it's not K that bootstraps that relationship. It's Visual Studio and its internal knowledge of IIS Express.
Yeah, correct. If you wanted to get the same IIS Express command line experience, it's not hard. You just have to know what the IIS Express command line is. So you can go to the right directory, type IIS Express, run in this port on this folder, and it finds that folder, locates the K runtime, initializes it, it runs the web application. So you can do IIS Express from the command line. Exactly like Visual Studio is doing, if you just know what the one or two switches are that you need.
Would that be something I'd want to put in here if I wanted to run IIS Express from the command line as a command within a project.json?
IIS Express might be the one that's different, only because it doesn't have a managed DLL entry point.
Oh, I see. So you need to have your own little managed utility to do that for you.
I would probably do it as a batch file.
To your point from before, hey, it's the most simple thing that could happen. Why make it more complicated?
Yeah, and then if somebody sees it in the folder, they can just double-click it, and IIS Express opens up in its own DOS box, and you see the output, and things start serving.
So we're going to talk about Kestrel in a minute, but what is Microsoft.ASP.NET.Hosting?
Oh, Microsoft ASP.NET Hosting, that is the entry point that understands your startup class.
Okay.
I feel like we might want to open just to take a look at the code.
Oh, well, let's do it.
Yeah. So if we open this up and get some of these out of the way, this is the folder that we were just looking at.
All right.
There is the program main that khello would run. Hosting is a different entry point. It has a program main, and what its job is to find your code and your startup class, create that startup class, and then give it control. So hosting will load this. And I'm sure you've seen this demoed a lot today.
And does it find it by its name, startup? Is that a convention?
Yeah. Startup is a convention. Configure is a convention. So just like program main is a convention.
Well, that's a good point, because my pedantic brain was like, well, that's not really an interface, and shouldn't there be an I this or that? But in this case, public static void main, just because it's always been that way.
Yeah. And like we mentioned, the systems are IOC enabled, so that kind of fights having a base interface just a little bit, because if you put additional interfaces from the runtime that you want injected into this argument call or into this function call, an interface doesn't really let that happen because it'll tell you you haven't implemented that method correctly.
I see. So you're saying I can put whatever I want on configure, and not only will it find configure and startup by convention, but it'll also inject in those things.
Oh, yeah.
For me.
Mm-hmm. Yep. You can get the hosting environment, Logger Factory, those other kind of things.
That puts logging really early in the process. That's pretty cool.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, we definitely have taken some of those building blocks and made them optionally available. Not mandatory, but if you want to click into the logging interfaces that are available, they're front and center, and all you really have to do is ask for them, and they end up in your hand.
All right, cool.
So that is what hosting's job is, to locate this, And then your program puts whatever handler it wants on there. Mm-hmm. And this would be, you know, add MVC, or this is, you know, the Hello World
right,
example.
The Hello World example.
And then that's all there is to it. That's hosting's job. If you are hosting on in IIS or on HTTP Sys, the same DLL is going through that code path. So IIS gives control to hosting, which locates the startup class in the same way. So whether you're self-hosted or IIS hosted, the execution path is as similar as possible.
Okay, let's switch back to the slides and talk just briefly about Kestrel, and then in the context of potentially other places that we could host this stuff.
Sure.
Well, Kestrel is just something that you kind of slapped together that suddenly people started using.
Well, it's been kicking around for a little bit.
Did you expect it to be anything more than like a kind of a, here, this is a little thing I built? Did you intend to go and build a managed web server that people really start using?
Both. It started off as a exercise in getting code that was sort of running the same everywhere, mm-hmm. and also it's something that, and it wasn't just me. You know, lots of people have been like asking for this and, mm-hmm. and pushing for it, and Fowler has been on the Twitters, you know, asking people where is the managed HTTP server for .NET. You know,
right.
Java's got Jetty. These other things have like purely managed HTTP servers. What does the community think of that? You know, who wants to start running one? And so there were some people that were working on that already. This one is coming together. It's based on libuv and
libuv,
yes.
libuv. That's the one that Node uses.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So it's using the libuv evented socket API libraries, mm-hmm. And so that's how it's talking to the internet. Other than that, it is basically doing the HTTP framing. So to be an HTTP server, you have to understand the request and you have to serialize the response.
Mm-hmm.
Other than going through all of the things to make it production ready and trustworthy computing, and that huge bar, Microsoft sets a huge bar for what it considers to be production server.
Mm.
Other than that, HTTP itself is a fairly basic protocol. You know, once you get the framing and the bodies out of the
sure,
way,
sure.
All you have to do is transceive things. At that point, you have a managed code HTTP server. You can use it from a host process on Windows. And on Windows, you can choose between HTTP Sys and Kestrel.
Mm-hmm.
And if you are going cross-platform, you can take your server with you. You obviously don't have IIS available, but you can run a process. And once you're in that process, you can boot whichever web server you want to.
How complicated is Kestrel? Like, how much code are we talking about here? Like, does it make it easier to get it past trustworthy computing because there's not a lot of code?
Trustworthy computing, they have extremely specific and very sophisticated things they look for. O of N attacks, bad data, how, you know, protocol vulnerabilities, the everything that you can think of. So being simple helps, but being simple isn't enough. There's a lot of things that I couldn't even, you know, begin to enter into.
So it's going through that process?
Yes, and it will need to be through that process before it's, you know, called anything close to production ready.
And arguably, do you think it'll make it through that process and it'll be something that people could have as an option?
Oh, yeah, someday. Yeah, someday, certainly. Mm-hmm. Yes.
So then when someone is putting a Node application live in production, they're not necessarily, they're going to run node.exe, but they're not going to take that port and put it out into the real world. They're going to front it with something.
Oh, yeah, yeah. You'll definitely think twice before making Node your front-end server. You will, as often as not, and I don't know what the percentages are, but I think it's at least half of the instances will have Nginx or some sort of HTTP front server, often configured to do the static files, to take that load off of the Node process itself, but also because it can be considered in some ways a more robust server for some of the attacks that you can do on an HTTP mm-hmm. Sort of like socket.
So the kind of stuff like people ask themselves, like, what exactly does IIS do? You know, I mean, it does the static file, it does the different routing from requests from different kinds of, it's a component container, lifecycle management, all that kind of stuff. In mm-hmm. the Unix world, sometimes you'll take two or three different utilities that will do that kind of work.
Mm-hmm.
So then would you anticipate when someone says something like, you know, some of these simple tweeted questions, how do I run ASP.NET applications on Apache? That's going to be a more complicated question about, like, well, how do I have Apache as my front web server doing the static files with then brokered calls over to Kestrel, some future version of Kestrel?
Mm-hmm.
We're going to have to come up with prescription for that.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And probably, you know, really good examples and articles, you know, assuming that they reach the point where they're production ready. And you kind of have that experience, like you alluded to, with a different technology. If you search for how do I put Nginx in front of Node, you find a lot of articles. And then you find, you basically pick the one that makes the most sense to you and seems like the stablest source, and then follow them like a script.
Yeah, I think people have been a little spoiled because things like IIS can be put right on the front end, or things like Apache can be put right out there. But now you've got, you know, Nginx and other firewalls and other things like Redis and Mongo and all these different things. And some people put them out there on the open internet, and some people don't.
Well, and the fact of the matter is that when you're talking about cloud hosting, even if you do run a process that is its own web server, you are virtually never the front server that's on the edge of the internet.
That's true.
You're almost always behind at least a network appliance and often a routing layer.
Yeah. Which protects you from a whole bunch of things.
Yeah, a whole category of attacks, yeah.
Yeah, you don't want to be on the open internet.
No, at least not without the right tools.
Yeah. Cool. Well, we have been learning all about ASP.NET internals from Louis Desjardins. You can check him out at whereslou.com, as well as follow him on Twitter. And we will be back talking to Rowan Miller and talking about the Entity Framework 7.